The Alpha King held the dying Luna. His touch alone sealed every wound. I had been to 100 battlefields and carried 100 wounded wolves back to camp on my own back. I had stood at the edges of death more times than I could count, and I had never flinched. That was what they said of me, the Alpha King of Stonehaven, unmoved by injury, unmoved by grief, unmoved by anything the world threw at my feet. They were wrong. There was one thing that unmoved me. One single sight that cracked me open from the inside, and it happened in a snow-white ravine on the eastern border of my territory, on the coldest night of the year. It was the sight of her lying still in the blood-stained snow. I need to go back further than that night, or none of it will make sense. My pack, Stonehaven, sat on a high ridge above a river valley, and we were a warrior pack, the largest in the Northern Territories, feared across every border we shared. I had ruled since I was 23, when my father's heart gave out after the Third Border War. I had been ruling for 12 years since, and in all those years I had not taken a Luna. My council reminded me of this at least once a month. My generals grumbled about it. My wolves, the great gray spirits that ran in the mountains around Stonehaven and answered to my bloodline, did not seem to care at all, which I took as a sign they were wiser than the council. I had nothing against finding a mate. I simply believed the bond would tell me, and until it did, I had no interest in forcing the question. Some alphas chose on politics or beauty or pack alliances. I intended to wait for the pull my father had described to me once, quietly, when I was still a boy. He said it was like a compass needle locking north for the first time and realizing it had been spinning your whole life. "You do not find it," he said. "It finds you." It had not found me in 12 years of ruling, until her. Her name was Wren, and she arrived at Stonehaven on a gray morning in early winter, traveling with a small border pack called Greyfen that had asked for sanctuary. Greyfen had been driven east by a pack called Ironhold, bigger, hungrier, poorly led, and they came to us with nothing but their people and what they could carry. I gave them shelter on the lower slopes. It was not charity. Greyfen's border position was strategically useful, and their healer's knowledge of the eastern mountain passes was worth more than the grain they would cost me. Their healer was Wren. I noticed her the first time at the resettlement meeting in the lower hall. She was not the one who spoke. That was Greyfen's interim alpha, an older man called Aldous, who spoke with careful dignity and thanked me more times than was necessary. Wren sat at the table's edge, quiet and still, with a satchel of herbs across her knees and her hands folded over it, and she was watching me with level gray eyes that did not look away when I looked back. Most people looked away. She did not. She was young, perhaps 24 or 25, with dark hair pinned back from her face, and the kind of stillness about her that healers often have, the stillness of someone who has sat with pain long enough that it no longer frightens them. She wore a worn gray cloak patched at the shoulder and boots that had seen at least two winters. She was nothing like what my council imagined for my Luna. She had no title, no bloodline that meant anything to a council chamber, no political weight. My wolf noticed her before I had finished the thought. I do not mean he stirred, I mean he went absolutely still inside my chest, in the way that water goes still, just before a stone breaks the surface, and then every sense I had sharpened down to a single point, to her. The pull my father had described hit me behind the sternum like a blow from the inside. I kept my face level. I was an alpha king. I had 12 years of practice keeping my face level. I finished the meeting, assigned Greyfen their quarters, and said nothing to anyone. But I knew. She was my mate. I was careful about it. I had not survived 12 years on a contested throne by acting on instinct without thought, and the situation required thought. Wren was a guest under my protection, displaced from her home, in a pack that depended on my goodwill. Coming at her the moment the meeting ended would have been a cruelty dressed as a claiming, and whatever I was not cruel. If the bond was real, and I knew it was, then it would wait. I would let her settle, let her find her footing, and then I would find a way to speak with her honestly, on ground where she was not beholden to me. So I waited. 3 days. On the fourth morning I went to the lower hall infirmary and found her at a table sorting dried herbs into small clay jars with the focused attention of someone who was very, very good at what they did. She looked up when I came in and did not scramble to her feet the way a guest usually did in the presence of the Alpha King. She simply looked at me and said, quietly, "Is someone injured?" "No," I said. A small pause. "Are you?" "No." She considered me for a moment with those gray eyes. Then she said, "Then you're here to say something, and you're not certain how to begin." I had not expected that. I almost smiled. "Yes." "Then I'll make it easier," she said, and set down the jar she was holding. I felt it too, in the meeting hall. I didn't say anything because you're the Alpha King and I'm a refugee from a border pack and the power is not evenly weighted between us, and I didn't want to presume. A beat. I still don't want to presume. I sat down across from her at the table. It was the most direct thing anyone had said to me in years. That was not about battle strategy or grain supplies. "You're not presuming," I said. "I came here precisely because I did not want you to feel as if you had no choice." Something shifted in her face. A small loosening. A breath she had been holding. "Good," she said. "Then let's talk honestly. I'm not interested in a claiming or a ceremony or a Luna's crown tonight. I'm interested in knowing who you are. And you could probably stand to know who I am." "I could," I said. "Yes." So we talked. Not about the bond, not about mates or titles or what Stonehaven expected. We talked about Greyfen. She had been their healer since she was 17, trained by an old woman who had lived alone on the eastern slopes and knew more about wolf medicine than anyone in three territories. We talked about what it felt like to heal a wolf that was dying when nothing in your kit should have been enough, and how you never quite got over the ones you lost. We talked about winter in the mountains. We talked until the morning light had moved halfway across the infirmary floor, and someone knocked on the door to tell me my generals were waiting. I left, and I felt her eyes on my back as I went. It was the warmest I had felt in years. The weeks that followed were the best kind of slow. I visited the infirmary most mornings on some pretext. A wolf injured in a training bout, a question about the eastern passes, once just a jar of good tea from the kitchens because she had mentioned she had run out. She did not pretend the visits were only about the pretext. She let me sit, and I let her work, and we talked the way people talk when they are learning someone properly, not just cataloging their surface. I learned she had a dry sense of humor, and a gift for rendering the pompous gently ridiculous without them realizing it. I learned she wept privately, over wolves she could not save, and said nothing about it where others could see. I learned she had been asked to leave Greyfen once, years ago, by a former alpha who thought a female healer had too much influence. She had refused to go, and the pack had quietly backed her instead of him. I learned she missed the mountains east of Greyfen's old territory the way you miss a limb. She learned, I think, that I was lonelier than my reputation suggested, and more careful of the people under my care than the stories told. She learned, I think, that I was lonelier than my reputation suggested, and more careful of the people under my care than the stories told. She learned that I had not laughed properly, not the brief controlled kind that kings produce at council dinners, but genuinely, from somewhere real, in several years, and that she could make me do it with a single dry observation delivered without any visible effort. She seemed to find this both flattering and lightly absurd, which was, I thought, exactly the right response. My council began to notice my visits. My head general, a grizzled man named Croft, said nothing for 2 weeks, and then one morning simply said, "She's not what they'll expect." He said it the way he delivered tactical assessments, without opinion attached, just the fact. "No," I said, "she's not." "Good," Croft said, which surprised me, and that was the end of it. The bond between us deepened the way deep things deepen. Not quickly, not in a moment of drama, but the way stone is shaped by water. Every morning I sat in the infirmary, I felt the pull grow more settled, more certain, less like a compass needle finding north, and more like north simply being the direction I faced now. I had not yet asked. I intended to ask properly, in a moment that was entirely about her, and not about Stonehaven's political calendar. I did not get the moment I intended. What I got was the night of the Eastern Raid. It began just after midnight on the first hard frost of the season. Ironhold, the pack that had driven Greyfen from their territory, sent a raiding party across the eastern border. Not a full war party, a fast, brutal group of 20, aiming for Stonehaven's border wolves before the snow grounded them for the season. My border wolves were my smallest units, 8 strong, posted at the 3 mountain passes to watch for exactly this. They were good wolves. They were outnumbered by more than 2 to 1. The warning drum reached the Great Hall at 12:30. I was already moving before it finished. I took Croft and 14 of my best with me, riding hard for the Eastern Pass. The mountain road was black and icy, and the horses knew the ground better than our eyes could, so we let them lead. My wolf burned in my chest, not with the pull I had grown accustomed to, but with something sharper, more urgent, a feeling I could not name until later. He had been still and watchful since the night I first saw her, settled, calm. The calm of something that has found its direction and has no reason to pace. Now he was not calm. He was burning through me like the need to run in winter, like the edge of a fight. But underneath the urgency there was something older, something the stories talked about in the same breath as the bond, the knowledge, animal and absolute, that what was his was in danger. The pass fight was brutal and short. By the time we arrived, my border wolves had held the main approach and driven Ironhold's party back into the ravine, but not without cost. Two of my wolves were down. Croft called the count, and I was already moving toward the injured when I saw her. Wren. She was in the ravine. She should have been in Stonehaven, in the infirmary, nowhere near a border raid. And she was in the ravine, kneeling in the snow over one of my border wolves, who had been left behind in the retreat when his leg gave out. Her satchel was open beside her, her hands already working, and the wolf, a young male named Dex, barely 19, was looking up at her with the glazed calm of someone held back from the edge by another person's absolute focus. She had come out herself, alone, into a live border fight, because one of my wolves had been left behind. I heard Croft's sharp intake of breath beside me. I was already running. I was 10 yards from her when I heard it, a sound from the east face of the ravine, above us. The sudden crack of ice giving way under a weight that had been pressed into the rock face and then moved. One of Ironhold's party, still in the ravine, repositioning. The shot was for Dex, I think. A final spite, a last blow at a wounded wolf of mine before the retreat. Wren heard it too. She heard it a half second before I reached her, and she did what healers do when a threat comes for their patient and there is no time for anything else. She covered him with her body. The shot took her across the back and shoulder. She did not cry out. She folded over Dex slowly, the way things fall that are very tired, and my hands caught her before she reached the snow. I need to say something about the sound of it, because I have thought about it so many times since, and I think it matters. She did not cry out. Most people cry out, even warriors who have trained since they were children, because pain is involuntary and the body tells the truth even when the mind does not want it to. Wren made no sound at all. There was the impact, which I felt in the same half second she did, because the bond between us was so close to the surface by then, and then there was her folding, slowly, not collapsing, the way someone sits down when they are very tired, as if she were simply deciding that lying down was necessary now, and she was going to do it with whatever grace was available to her. It was the most terrible grace I have ever seen. The next few seconds I remember in fragments. Croft bellowing. Dex's voice, high and horrified, her name repeated, my own hands pressing against the wound in Wren's back through her cloak, feeling the heat and the wrongness of it, the way a wound feels different when it is serious. Her weight against my chest, slight, smaller than she seemed when she was upright and composed and running the infirmary with quiet authority. And underneath all of it, the burning. I had heard the old stories about the mate bond. Every alpha raised in the north knew them. The tales of what happens when a fated pair is threatened, when one half of a destined bond is injured. My father had told me once, matter-of-factly, that the bond is a living thing, and that it can be called. I had not understood what he meant. I understood it now. My hands were pressed to her wound, and the burning moved from my palms outward, along my forearms, up through my chest. Not painful, not like fire. Like light behaves in deep water, diffuse and deep and warm, filling the space where cold had been. It came from somewhere beneath my ribs, from the place the bond lived, from everything the last 6 weeks had been building to. It poured from my hands into the wound in her back, and for a long, terrible moment, nothing seemed to happen. And then, she breathed. Not the short, shallow breathing of someone losing blood too fast. A deep breath, a full one, the kind the body only takes when it is coming back from somewhere rather than going. I felt her back rise under my palms. Her hands, which had been slack in the snow, curled. Dex made a sound I had never heard a 19-year-old warrior make, A single, low sound that was entirely grief turning into something else. I pressed my palms harder and I did not look away from her. Whatever the bond was doing, I was not going to stop it. I would have given every last thing I had, every year of my life banked up since I was a boy learning to be a king, every morning in the infirmary drinking tea and listening to her tell me I was too serious. I would have given all of it in one breath, unhesitatingly, if it meant she did not die in that ravine. The wound slowed, then it stopped. I did not understand what I was seeing. I was pressing my hands to her back, and through the torn cloth I could feel the wound closing. Not quickly, not entirely, but closing. The heat of it reversing, the blood clotting, the way blood does only when the body has decided to fight rather than surrender. It was the bond. I did not have the language for it then, though I would find the language later. All I knew in that moment was that whatever the mate bond was made of, it was pouring out of me and into her, and she was not dying. She was not dying. I carried her back to Stonehaven myself. Croft offered a litter. I looked at him, and he did not offer again. I carried her the 2 miles back down the mountain road with her wrapped in my cloak, and my arms tight around her, and my wolf ran still and low in my chest, not burning anymore but watchful, the watchfulness of something that has been tested to its limit, and has not broken, and does not intend to. Behind me I could hear my wolves, the border unit, the ones who had held the pass tonight, following at a distance. They did not speak. They moved quietly in the dark, and their presence felt like something I had not known Stonehaven's fighting wolves were capable of, a collective gentleness, a deliberate hush, as if they understood that the thing being carried was precious, and that noise would be a violation of it. I thought of what my father had said about the bond, and I thought that perhaps a Luna does not only matter to an Alpha King, perhaps the pack itself feels the bond when it exists, some deep current that runs beneath speech and strategy, and the daily work of running a territory, and they feel when that current is in danger, and they feel when it holds. She was conscious for parts of it and not for others. Once, for a few minutes on the flat part of the road, she came fully awake, and she looked up at my face from where her head rested against my shoulder with an expression I have never seen on anyone else's face. Not the disorientation of someone hurt, not fear, but a clear, exhausted recognition. She knew exactly where she was, and how she had gotten there, and what had passed in the ravine. "You're the one who held me," she said. "Yes." The wound? She stopped. Her hand moved to her shoulder, feeling through the cloak. Her face changed. "It's almost closed." "That shouldn't..." Another stop, a long moment of stillness. "I know," I said. "The bond," she said, and it was not a question. "Yes." She was quiet for a while after that. Then she said, very softly, "You gave me a lot of yourself." "Whatever it cost," I said, "it was not enough. It will never be enough for what you did." "She covered him," Dex said from behind us. His voice was raw. She covered him without thinking. She didn't hesitate. "I know," I said. "I saw." Ren said nothing more until we reached the gates of Stonehaven, and then she only said, "Put me down. I can walk in on my own." I almost did not. I nearly argued, on the grounds that the wound, however much the bond had closed it, was still not healed properly, and walking was inadvisable. But I looked at her face and saw the thing I had come to know over 6 weeks of mornings, her absolute quiet insistence on her own dignity, the same dignity she had brought to the meeting hall when she arrived with nothing, the same dignity she would not have set aside even in the worst of it. I set her down carefully. She walked in on her own. I stayed close enough to catch her if she stumbled. She did not stumble. The days after the ravine were quieter than I expected. Ren's shoulder healed in 4 days instead of the usual 2 weeks for that kind of wound. "Testimony," my senior healer Mira said with wide eyes, to what had happened on the mountain road. The bond seal was not complete healing. It was more like the body being given a running start. The wound knit past the point of danger. The rest left to natural recovery. Ren supervised her own recovery with the professional efficiency of someone who found it deeply uncomfortable to be on the receiving end of care. She gave Mira quite precise instructions about her own treatment, and Mira, to her credit, mostly followed them. I visited each morning. I did not stay long, she was healing, and rest was part of that, but I came. I brought the good tea. I sat in the chair by the window while she told me things she had not told me before, the way people do when they have passed through something together and the walls between them are thinner. She told me about her first winter alone in the mountains when she was 17, learning from the old healer, the two of them in a stone cottage with nothing for company but wolves and weather, and how she had been terrified for the first month and at peace for the rest of it. She told me that she had known since she was a girl that she would never be the kind of woman who waited to be chosen, that she had always gone toward the thing that needed doing, regardless of whether it was her station to do it, and she understood that this was both her greatest strength and the reason she ended up in ravines at midnight. I told her about my father. I told her what he said about the bond, the compass needle locking north, and how I had spent 12 years waiting for it. I told her that when I walked into the lower hall meeting and saw her with her satchel across her knees and her gray eyes not looking away, I had understood for the first time that my father had undersold it considerably. It was not like a compass needle. It was like the entire magnetic field of the world reorganizing around a single point, and the point was her. She laughed at that. It was the best thing I had heard in 12 years of kingship. "That's almost poetic," she said, for a man who speaks mostly in single-sentence tactical assessments. "I've been saving up," I said. "On the fifth day," I asked. I had thought about it, and I had decided I did not want ceremony or formality or an audience. I did not want to do it in the Great Hall with the council watching and Stonehaven's future weighing on every word. I did not want to do it the way alphas were supposed to do it, the formal presentation, the council witnesses, the treaty language embedded in what should be something simple. I had watched too many Alpha Kings perform that ceremony and emerge from it with the right signatures on the right documents and nothing warm between them and the woman they had just bound themselves to. I wanted to do it the same way we had done everything else, at the small table in the infirmary, in the good morning light, with the herbs in their clay jars and her gray eyes on my face, and no pretense between us. I came in with the tea, and sat down and set both cups on the table, and looked at her and said, "I have a question for you, not as the Alpha King, just as the man who carried you off a mountain." She looked at me steadily. "All right. I want to ask for your mark. Not for Stonehaven, and not because the council needs a Luna announcement before winter. For me. Because these 6 weeks have been the best of my adult life, and the worst moment of my adult life was the 10 seconds between when that shot landed and when I felt you breathe. And I do not want to spend the next 12 years without you." A pause. "I am asking, not claiming, and I want your honest answer, whatever that is." She was quiet for a long moment, long enough that my wolf, for the first time in days, began to pace. Then she said, "Yes. Just that." Not because it was the politically correct thing to say to the Alpha King who had sheltered her pack. Not because the bond had been building for 6 weeks and the answer was obvious. But because she said it the way she said everything, looking at me directly, without flinching, as something she had decided for herself. "Yes," she said again, and something in her voice softened. "I decided yes a long time before tonight. I was waiting for you to be brave enough to ask." I laughed. I did not laugh very often. She seemed pleased with herself. The marking was quiet and deliberate, just the two of us in the infirmary, in the morning light, with Mira as witness because the bond required one. It was nothing like the public ceremonies I had watched other alphas perform, all pageantry and announcement. It was a hand placed over a wrist, and the warmth of the bond sealing between us, and the mate mark blazing silver white on both our wrists at once, her wrist and mine. The same mark, mirror image, the way faded bonds mark their people. Mira made a sound that was not quite dignified, and then composed herself and bowed, and I think she wept a little on her way out. The mark on my wrist matched the color of the moonlight that had come through the infirmary window the night before the ravine, and I thought about that later, how the bond had been so close to the surface already that even the light had looked like it. Ren looked at her wrist for a long moment after the marking, and then looked up at me and said, practically, "Now, before we do anything else, Dex needs the stitches in his leg checked and the dressing on his shoulder changed, and I am not yet fully recovered enough to manage it alone. Are you going to help me, or are you going to stand there looking stricken?" "I'm not stricken," I said. "You look stricken." "I'm moved," I said. "There's a difference." She smiled. It was the one that reached her eyes, the one I had been cataloging for 6 weeks. "Help me with Dex's dressing," she said, "and then you can be as moved as you like." The council's reaction was what I expected. My senior advisor, a man called Hawthorne who had spent 15 years recommending various pack daughters and alliance brides, sat very still when I told him, and then said, carefully, "She is Greyfen's healer. There is no bloodline to speak of." "No," I said. "The Eastern Pack alliances won't consider her a political asset." "No," I said. A pause. "Is there a bloodline argument to be made? A hidden lineage? Some council-approved reason I can offer the Outer Pack lords when they ask?" "No," I said, for the third time. "The reason is that she is my mate, and I have marked her, and she has marked me, and the mate bond between us sealed her wounds on the Eastern Mountain Road, and she walked into Stonehaven on her own feet after taking a shot that should have killed her. That is the argument. The Outer Pack lords can draw their own conclusions." I paused, and then I added, "Because it was true and Hawthorne deserved the full version. And in the 6 weeks before that night, I had more honest conversation in that infirmary than in 12 years of council chambers. She has an honest mind and a healer's hands, and she is the only person I have met who tells me things I need to hear without wrapping them in what they think I want to hear. If you want to know what Stonehaven's Luna brings to this pack, that is your answer. Not a bloodline, herself." Hawthorne was quiet for a long time. Then he said, which surprised me considerably, "The wolves have been restless for 3 years. Every general I speak with says the same thing. They can feel it, something the pack needs that isn't being supplied." I did not think the answer was a healer from a border pack. He paused. I think I may have been wrong about what the pack needed. He was not the only one. The story traveled through Stonehaven the way stories always travel through a pack, in fragments and embellishments and the occasional wildly inaccurate detail, but the core of it intact. That the Alpha King's mate had gone alone into a border raid because one of Stonehaven's wolves was left behind. That she had covered him with her own body. That the Alpha King had carried her off the mountain with his hands sealed over her wound. That the bond between them had lit like a furnace and pulled her back from the edge. "My wolves, the great gray spirits of the mountain, came to the lower hall infirmary the morning after the marking, not one or two, but all of them, a slow, quiet procession. They lay down in the hall outside the infirmary door, and they stayed there until Wren came out. And when she did, they did not surge toward her the way excited wolves do. They were simply still. They looked at her with the golden gravity that the mountain wolves have, the look they have when they are in the presence of something old and true. And then, one by one, they lowered their great heads. I had not seen all my wolves bow at once before. Not for my father, not for me. Dex was standing at the far end of the hall when it happened, his leg still bandaged, leaning against the wall, and he was crying without any attempt to hide it, and I did not say anything about it, because I understood completely. Wren became Stonehaven's Luna in the first week of deep winter, at a ceremony that was, by her firm request, shorter than every ceremony Stonehaven had held in the past century, and followed immediately by dinner, because, as she pointed out with the crisp practicality I had come to treasure, announcing a Luna to a pack of several hundred wolves without immediately feeding them afterward was bad management. She was not wrong. The dinner was excellent. The pack seemed delighted. Hawthorne gave a speech that was surprisingly warm. Croft, who spoke at exactly no ceremonies, said three words, "She'll do," and somehow managed to make it sound like the highest possible praise. Dex, sitting near the back on his healing leg, did not say anything at all, but he had chosen a seat right at the end of a bench where he could see her face through the whole evening, and his expression was one I knew. It was the expression of someone who owes a debt they can never repay and has decided to spend the rest of their life in the attempt. Wren handled it all with the composure I had expected and the warmth I had come to depend on. She spoke briefly and well, without ceremony language or formal distance, just directly, that she was glad to be at Stonehaven, that she was honored by the trust of the pack, that she intended to know every wolf in this hall by name before spring. She said the last part matter-of-factly, the way she said everything, and half the hall laughed at the absurdity of it and then realized she meant it exactly as stated and stopped laughing. She did mean it exactly as stated. She started the next morning. What the council had been wrong about, what Hawthorne admitted quietly to me in the weeks that followed, was the nature of what a Luna gives a pack. They had been thinking in political terms, bloodlines and alliances and the leverage of a great family name. They had been wrong not because those things are worthless, but because they had mistaken what Stonehaven's wolves were actually missing. They had been missing a healer who showed up. Not for ceremonies, not for announcements, but in the infirmary at 2 in the morning, when a wolf came in from a night patrol with a wound going bad. In the lower quarters where Greyfen's families had been housed, sitting with the children and learning which ones were frightened of what, and which ones needed a different kind of quiet. At the gates when a new wolf came in from a pack the council hadn't heard of, assessing them not for political usefulness, but for what they needed. She did not do any of this loudly. That was the thing. There was no announcement. There was just Wren, with her satchel and her gray eyes, and her absolute refusal to be deterred by rank or convention, or the politely maintained idea that the Alpha King's Luna should remain in the ceremonial halls and the formal chambers. She was everywhere that wolves needed attending, and the pack felt it the way packs feel things, not with words, but with a slow, gathering warmth, like coming in from the cold. They started coming to the infirmary voluntarily, wolves who in previous years would have waited until a wound was bad enough that they had no choice. They came early, for small things, on the pretense of needing Mira's herb stock checked or a minor patrol scrape dressed. But what they were actually coming for was the thing healers, who are also the right kind of person, give without knowing they give it. The sense that someone sees you, and the seeing is without judgment. My wolves, the mountain spirits, took to following her on her rounds. Not in a pack, not dramatically. In ones and twos. At a respectful, proprietary distance. The way wolves follow people they have decided belong to them. Croft observed this once and said, solemnly, "She's organized my wolves better than any general." I was not sure whether he meant it as a criticism. I chose to take it as a compliment. In the months that followed, I learned other things. I learned that she snored very slightly in cold weather, and was deeply unbothered by this. I learned that she had a gift for reading weather from the sky that was more accurate than any of my scout's instruments, which she attributed to years in the mountains with the old healer, and which I privately suspected was something else entirely. I learned that she was capable of complete, focused silence for hours at a time, when she was working on a particularly difficult case, and that this silence was companionable rather than cold, and that sitting in it with her, while she worked and I read reports, was the most comfortable I had ever been in my own life. I learned that she held a quiet, enduring grief for the wolves she had lost in her years at Greyfen, an accounting she kept privately, not spoken about, not displayed. Once I found her sitting by the window in the very early morning before the household was awake, very still, with her hands folded in her lap, and I knew without asking that she was doing the kind of remembering that healers do. I sat down beside her and said nothing, and she leaned her shoulder against mine and said nothing, and after a while the light changed and she stood up and said, "I'll start the morning round," and went, and I understood that for Wren, being Luna of a pack with the resources to actually save the ones she might have lost before, was a kind of atonement she was quietly committed to, and that this commitment would outlast any politics or ceremony or alliance the council could ever negotiate. I was right about that. In 3 years she halved the pack's winter wound deaths. That was not a metaphor. That was Stonehaven's actual count. Croft put it in his annual report to the Outer Pack Lords with zero embellishment. Survival rates, injured wolves, winter quarter, improved by half since the change in healer leadership. The Outer Pack Lords, who had been skeptical about the Luna with no bloodline, had nothing to say about that. They were not the last to run out of objections. The moment I think about most, when I look back at that first year, is not the ravine, though the ravine is the one the stories tell. It is not the ceremony in the Great Hall, or the first morning after the marking. It is a morning in late winter, the pack asleep, the mountain quiet under new snow, the infirmary warm with the smell of herbs and pine resin and the good tea she had finally gotten the kitchen to stock properly. She was at the table, writing in her case notes. She kept meticulous case notes for every wolf in Stonehaven, which she had done since her first week and which were now filling their third book. And I was reading the Border Patrol reports at the other end of the table, and we were both completely absorbed and completely present to each other, in the way that only happens with someone you have chosen correctly. She looked up at some point and caught me watching her. "You do that quite often," she said. "I know. Is it something I should be concerned about?" "No," I said. "I spent 12 years not finding this. I'm making up for lost time." She looked at me for a moment with the expression I liked best. the one where her composure was still intact but something warmer moved behind it, the thing she had been careful with until she wasn't anymore. Then she returned to her case notes. "Fair enough," she said, "pass the tea." That is what I would tell anyone who asked how an Alpha King, one who had ruled alone for 12 years and was not looking for anything, found his fated mate. I would tell them it was not in a ceremony hall, not at a mating rite, not in any of the approved places where such things are supposed to happen. It was in the most ordinary possible place, a lower hall meeting, a table covered with clay jars of herbs, a pair of gray eyes that did not look away. And I would tell them that the bond is not the ceremony. The ceremony is for the pack. The bond itself is everything that came before it. Every morning in the infirmary, every conversation that went longer than it needed to, every cup of tea left on a table for someone who hadn't asked for it. The bond is the accumulation of choosing, over and over, to stay and be honest and show up. The mate mark is how it announces itself to the world. But the choosing, that is what makes it real. She had chosen. She had chosen in a ravine on a cold mountain in the dark, when she covered a young wolf with her body and did not hesitate. She had chosen every morning since, in every infirmary round, and every case note, and every meeting where she sat in a council chamber that did not know what to do with her, and was patient and direct and utterly herself. I had chosen too. I choose still, every morning, when I come to the table and set down the tea and sit across from her in the good winter light, and she looks up from her notes with those gray eyes and does not look away. She never looks away. The bond, my wolf, the mark on my wrist, the memory of her weight in my arms on a dark mountain road, all of it says the same thing, over and over, in the language beneath language that only mates understand. This one, this one, this was always the one. I believe it. End.